Philip Blum is the author of a book called To Have and To Hold, An Intimate History of Collectors and Collecting. Blum told Anne Strainchamps about the history of collecting holy relics.
There was a large trade in holy relics, and to some extent there is still today. And of course in the Middle Ages the big problem was that when you got the bleached bones of Saint so-and-so, there was no way of telling whether those were the bleached bones of a saint or of a robber or of a Saracen or of a double murderer. They all look the same. And so people have done calculations of how many thigh bones of a particular saint there in Europe, and it's usually something like 16. I think John the Baptist has at least two heads and five arms or so. One thing that is important about holy relics is that I think holy relics give you an immediate in into what collecting really is all about and why collectors don't use the things that they have. Think of someone who collects rock star memorabilia and who's got a T-shirt that Mick Jagger wore in 1960-something, or, you know, the shoes that Paul McCartney was seen in a London stage or something like that. Now, those are relics. Those are secular relics. Think of someone who's got Abraham Lincoln's autograph. That's a holy relic because it connects you to him.
Is that the thing we're looking for, the connection to somebody who's gone or who will never be connected to us in real life?
I think it's the connection to something that we are looking for, the connection to something we aspire to, we love, we want to be like. And I think that is very important for collectors. You know, a collection is a remarkable thing because it is a little universe that is ordered and that you can master. Maybe you can't master your life. You certainly can't master international politics. You can't even master the traffic in your city. But there in this room is stuff where you can say, this is important, this is valuable, this I'll throw out. This is my most precious piece. I will arrange them in this kind of hierarchy. And there you are the master of the world. And so this idea that it is a connection to a kind of better world, which is ordered, which is beautiful, which has genius, which has all sorts of things that you really want. Perhaps the world is in the past, perhaps it is still in the present, but it is anyway something that you want to have a connection with, just like Catholic people want, through a relic, have a connection to holiness, have a connection to God, because they believe that if you pray in front of a relic, the prayer is more efficacious. So I think their holy relics show you the nature of collected objects.
What about if you move forward in history and move into, say, American collectors and some of the great ones, the great millionaire collectors like William Randolph Hearst, for instance, the newspaper tycoon? What sort of collector was he?
Well, I mean, William Randolph Hearst was one of these people who really want to dominate the world. He played a deciding part in two American presidential elections. Nowadays, the idea that media play a deciding part in presidential elections isn't all that astonishing. Back then, it was really novelty. He also actually started a war, or got his government to start a war. He was someone who wanted mastery. He wanted to possess everything. Now, of course, you can't possess everything, but he had a crack at it. He bought things. He had a fabulous income. In today's terms, it would be, I think, something like $500 million a year. And he managed to spend it all, and he managed to get terribly in debt. Because he bought things. Now, there's two kinds of collectors that you can often see. That's why this book is called To Have and To Hold, because there are people who want to conquer, who want to have this moment of getting something and have this great pleasure, and then they almost lose interest in it. And there are people who want to possess something, who want to know it's theirs and nobody else's. Now, that was what Randolph William Hearst was doing.
In other words, there are people who collect for love and there are people who collect for power.
In a way, yes. Hearst had things that he ordered by catalogue or he saw in a shop or something like that, and he bought it and had it straight shipped to his magazines. And he never saw the stuff again. It was stocked. There were thousands of cases containing entire parts of buildings, but also works of art and armour and furniture. Hearst also had a whole huge herd of cattle. He had, of course, cars, but also aeroplanes. He had an enormous zoo, and he was somebody, and that is also another thing that I think is significant about Collected, he was acutely afraid of death. So much so that when a tree died on the grounds in his fairy tale castle, the gardeners would either paint it or remove it and replace it before he realized, because otherwise he would throw a terrible fit. If one of his associates died, he would send his lawyers to the funeral. He wanted to have nothing to do with death.
Do you think this is true of many collectors, that that drive to acquire is about staving off the fear of death?
Well, you know, if you think of the grave of a pharaoh, it contains a little symbolic world. And that little symbolic world is supposed to serve the pharaoh to live beyond his life, to live in another world.
What about today? Have we become a society of collectors?
It is very interesting today because collecting was revolutionized at the beginning of the 20th century quite simply because mass-produced objects became so much more readily available. It meant that you no longer had to be a rich bourgeois or a nobleman to acquire an interesting collection, but you could be a nobody. And you could find cigarette cards very interesting, or bits of porcelain, or anything that was basically didn't cost a lot of money. Matchboxes, something like that. But I think today there's a trend that I find very interesting because, of course, we live in a hugely standardized world. And we live in a world where everything becomes the victim of marketing. And today there are collector's editions of things. That means there are things that are no longer even supposed to enter into the stream of consumption or use, but that just skip that moment altogether and are just put into collector's cupboard straight away.
So we're producing the collectibles.
Yes, but also, of course, 30 years ago there was something like a big youth rebellion movement, and people wore torn clothes and had long hair just to show the older generation that they weren't like them. Today you can buy this all off the peg. You buy your torn designer jeans and you go to a fashionable hairdresser to have your hair long, and you buy the music that goes with it, the magazines that go with it, and you think you're making a gesture of protest, but actually you're just being a good little consumer. Now, some collectors have found an intelligent response to that by looking for oddities, because, you know, the great challenge in our world is to maintain our individuality. To not just be another Ralph Lauren kind of guy or another Tommy Hilfiger kind of kid, but to become you or me or somebody who cannot just be interchanged with somebody else in those clothes. So some collectors now, they look for books that has the page 16 three times in them, or they look for a line of dolls that Barbie put out once but that didn't work, and that was pulled from the market very quickly. They look for oddities. They look for the cracks in the perfect consumer utopia. And I find that very interesting because it seems to me to be an intelligent response to the world we're living in.
But it's just like King Rudolph or Peter the Great. They're still looking for the one-of-a-kind object.
Yes, they're still looking to assert their individuality through the world of things.
Philip Blom is the author of To Have and To Hold, An Intimate History of Collectors and Collecting. He spoke with Anne Strange Champs.